Thanks for listening into this week's episode. If you haven't checked out my website lately, go ahead and take a look. I've added some of my favorite products to the website, and they might become some of your favorite products. My guest on this week's episode is Kirby Lewis. He was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer at the age of 52. Kirby had a recurrence in 2016, at which time the cancer had metastasized to his lung. He shared how he found the breast cancer, his course of treatment, and how he feels like, ultimately, breast cancer saved his life. Kirby talks about his life's mantra and how he continues to live that mantra despite a diagnosis of cancer. Welcome to Behind the Pink Ribbon, where we share stories, information, and other content related to breast cancer. My name is Melissa Adams. I am a 12-year genetic breast cancer survivor. I've learned so much through my own journey with breast cancer. I have met some amazing people along the way, many that have become lifelong friends. I have experienced the emotional roller coaster of a breast cancer diagnosis, heartache, anger, frustration, loneliness, and even gratitude. Through this podcast, we will speak to breast cancer survivors, supporters, and healthcare professionals to gain insight and understanding behind the pink ribbon. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast, Kirby. It's so nice to have you.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for asking.
So let's talk a little bit about the beginning of your story. How did you find out that you had breast cancer or a lump? Or, you know, just tell me the beginning of where this all started for you.
Sure. It was the weirdest thing, really. I had been fighting a cold and a cough, a very persistent cough, for about 6 weeks. And it was just continually getting worse. And my congestion at night especially was bad. And I actually kind of thought that maybe it was allergy related, because it was early springtime. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, it's allergy related. So anyway, at night, my wife and I laid down in bed, and about 11:30 that night, I sat up coughing and heaving and just trying to get, you know, my breath. And when I did, I grabbed my chest. And with my right hand and on my left side, I noticed a lump. And so it was purely by accident, but almost immediately, and for some crazy reason, I have no, I don't have any basis to have this as a, I mean, there's nothing that I could say that would rationalize me thinking this, but for some reason, I knew it was breast cancer. I have no family history. So, I mean, it was just like, I just knew. And I woke my wife up, and, if you've ever heard, the old, saying that don't poke the bear, it is very true. I use a little bit of humor. I use a little bit of humor here because, Melissa, let me tell you something. We've been married 33 years, and trust me, you don't get through a marriage with everything that you have, raising a son and just life, you know, you don't get through all of that without injecting some humor. So
I agree.
I woke her up. Yeah. Yeah. And I woke her up and I said, honey, I found a lump in my breast. I think I have breast cancer. And she says, oh, for goodness sakes, go back to sleep. You have breast cancer and I have prostate cancer. Good night.
Oh, my goodness. She was definitely a bear that day.
Yes, yes. So fortunately, she did not have prostate cancer.
I'm glad.
That would have been a whole other conversation that we would be having. But unfortunately for me, after several weeks of tests and, you know, you go through the sonograms and the x-rays, and then I had a needle biopsy, and then I had an open biopsy. And after all of those, it was finally determined that, in fact, I did have breast cancer.
So I have two thoughts. One is actually a question, but I mean, I find it very fascinating that you, one, just immediately went to breast cancer, considering that there's not a family history. And I think that also lends itself to a little bit of surprise from my end, just because many of the men that I have spoken to, there has consistently been a family history. You know, so many times it goes back to like a BRCA mutation or, you know, the PAPI2 or like whatever genetic mutation. So to hear right. that, you know, there's not a family history from your end is just, you know, kind of surprising. And, you know, I think that's the other thing that I want to try to get out there is, you know, first of all, I want people to understand that men do get breast cancer and yes. also that it doesn't have to be related to a family history.
No, it does not. And that's the really one of the more important facets about breast cancer in general. There, you know, it doesn't, male or female, it does not have to be connected with with genes, genealogy or genetics or anything like that. It has, for me, I believe that it was environmental exposure. I was in the military in the United States Navy, and as many people know, we are exposed to all kinds of chemicals and just so many different things, from the water we drink that is being treated at sea to just the chemicals and the different types of asbestos and things like that that are in shipyards when you're in dry dock. So I just kind of feel as though that is probably where mine, you know, stems from.
Right. Well, and you bring something up. I hadn't thought about it for a little bit of time, but I do believe that there is a very large population of men who have been diagnosed with breast cancer that were stationed at, I want to say it was like Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Camp Lejeune. Yes. And yeah, Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. And then now more recently, of course, we're seeing a large pocket or a group of the first responders from 9/11. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the odd thing about that is, and this is the thing that I don't know how to connect the dots because I'm not a researcher. I'm not a PhD, so I don't understand all the chemical aspects and things like that. But you think about the first responders, and they're breathing in, again, all of these fumes, these toxins, and these just these fumes from the from what they experienced at 9/11. And now they are seeing a large volume of breast cancer.
Yes.
So it's kind of crazy. You would think I would associate breathing in these toxins is more probably that would materialize as a lung cancer, something related to that. But obviously the toxins affect people differently, and at least there's a large number of those that it is bringing breast cancer to, you know, to them. And that's unfortunate, of course. But
yeah, absolutely. So when you went to your doctor and you indicated that you found this lump, was your doctor, like, I'm just kind of curious, right? Like,
it's
a very small population of men who are diagnosed with breast cancer. So I think there's probably a tendency to be like, no, that's not what it is.
Yeah, I laugh because Melissa, I went in there and I was, like I said, I was pretty adamant that that's what it was. For some reason, I don't know. I just was confident that that's, you know, I've got breast cancer. And I went in, and this doctor was with the Veterans Administration. Now, the VA gets a bad rap on a lot of things, and I get excellent treatment and excellent care normally with the VA system, and I have nothing but bragging words for them. But in this particular instance, this doctor, he said, you don't have breast cancer. Men don't get it. You don't have breast cancer. And I said, really? And like I said, it was about maybe 3 weeks or something like that after that he finally came to the conclusion that, yes, I had breast cancer. And his bedside manner, to say the least, was not the warm, fuzzy type. So, you know, and also I might add that he's no longer my doctor.
Sometimes that's good.
Yeah, right.
I can appreciate that coming from just having been diagnosed at the age of 31. You know, my doctor had said to me the same thing, that it wasn't, you know, that it wasn't cancer, But I can't, you know, I know how hard that was for me, but I can't imagine the struggle of that as a man, particularly when you feel it in your gut, that you know that it's something and you really have pinpointed it to being breast cancer. But to have a doctor say, you know, just flat out, it's not breast cancer is a really hard pill to swallow when they haven't even done anything.
Right. Yeah. And again, that kind of goes to the reason why he's no longer my physician. Yeah, it's a little alarming. I think my first thoughts were, we'll get it out.
Yeah.
And that's kind of common with how I believe from what I've, you know, the ladies that I've talked with, that's pretty much, you know, the way they feel, you know, get it out.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, you just want to get it removed as soon as possible because we all know that, you know, they have a tendency to grow.
Right.
That was the first thing. And I said, well, let's schedule a surgery, you know, and he even procrastinated on that. He procrastinated for 6 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
Telling me that, yes, he did. Telling me that, well, he would have to be able to do the surgery, but he's trying to get things lined up here at the local VA. And finally I went in and, I demanded that he, give me a consult to another, an oncologist, at another facility. And so now I, go to the Washington DC VA.
Okay.
And like I said, I get excellent care, but you know, I think a lot of that, maybe this isn't the way it should be, but I think, you know, you get what you give in life. Mm-hmm. And, so, I mean, I get it. There's a lot of veterans that come in there and, you know, they're just bitter and they're mad at the world. And I get that. And I understand that. But for the large part, the staff are there really diligently trying to help, trying to make lives better and save lives and things. And they're just human beings. And a lot of times the veterans don't speak the kindest, you know, of words to these staffers and things. And it's a sad predicament. And unfortunately it can't, I mean, we're human, we're all human. So unfortunately it can't help but be reflected in the quality of healthcare that those individuals receive.
Right.
And, I mean, I've just kind of always, I don't want to say been a good patient, but I've always been a respectful person.
Yes.
And I just feel as though that's imperative in life, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely. So what did they, excuse me, sorry. What did they recommend in terms of a surgery? Was it a lumpectomy? Was it a mastectomy? Was it?
No, I had a full mastectomy.
And when you say full, did you do both?
On my left side.
On the left side.
No, just okay. On the left. Okay. Yeah, because the doctor assured me, they said, you know, it's very, very, very rare that a man would have both or a reason to have both breasts removed.
Okay.
Now, if you had a history, if you had a BRCA gene or something like that, that would be a different story. So I had that, and then I was immediately put on tamoxifen. And and that was all well and good, but I want to back up for just a second. Before the surgery, they discovered that I needed to have open heart surgery. So I tell a lot of people that breast cancer saved my life because literally it did. Had I not found a lump, not had the surgery, they would have never discovered that I was in dire need of open heart, and I would have just died from my heart. And my thoracic surgeon that did the open heart, he said, you know, he said, it's a blessing that wow, that they discovered this. So, you know, I have many, many levels of gratefulness. And I know that that's kind of an oxymoron or a kind of a ironic, weird thought to associate with breast cancer. But I can't help it. It's the life I've been given.
Yeah. Well, and so did they find that you needed to have the open heart surgery through the scans or like how did that happen?
Well, they were doing some preliminary tests to get me ready for the mastectomy. And in that, they discovered that, I guess through blood draws and things of this sort, and x-rays. And then they finally said, "We, you know what, we want to schedule a, like a stress test." Mm-hmm. And when they did that, they said, "No, you need to have open heart surgery."
Wow.
And at first they were going to put stents in, and they started to do that. And they said, "No, you need to have the open heart surgery. We can't do the stents."
Wow. So you had the open heart surgery first and then the mastectomy?
No, I could not have that.
Okay.
And yeah, I had to, because I would have had to wait 2 years after the open heart to have.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
So by having the mastectomy first, I was able to, in 3 months' time, be able to turn around and have the open heart.
Wow.
And it presented some problems. It really presented some problems. The first big problem, the first biggest hurdle, was actually before the surgery. The tamoxifen drove my triglyceride levels to what the thoracic surgeon described as industrial strength. Hmm. In fact, they went so high that has never been a record of anybody having triglyceride levels at 8,100.
Wow.
And mine were 8,100. And of course, they should be, 200 and 300.
Yeah.
So,
why did they even put you on tamoxifen? Like, that's,
well,
for me, it's confusing.
That was right. And that was just, I guess, the standard, routine, medicine that they treat, breast cancer patients. And unfortunately there's no, deviation, or there wasn't at that time. And really there still isn't, between how you treat a male breast cancer patient and how you treat a female breast cancer patient.
Right. And I mean, that's a huge problem.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is, because our body chemistries are, even though they're similar, they definitely are different.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So
and that holds true. That holds true for even twins.
Right.
I mean, because of what we are environmentally exposed to, what we consume, I mean, there's a lot of attributes that go into the chemical makeup of our bodies.
Right.
And, oftentimes those things are kind of overlooked or dismissed, and, we don't think of them. And we commonly look for genetic connections, the DNA strands and things like that. But that's, as in my case, is not even relevant.
Right. Well, and it's, I get that there is this standard of care, and, they have medications that are provided for the majority of the population, that, the tamoxifen may work for most of the people. But, again, exactly what you said, everybody's body is different. The way my body responded to tamoxifen is very different from the next person and the next person.
Right.
But I was a little shocked when you said that they had put you on tamoxifen, because I'm thinking, I have never come across a man that has been prescribed tamoxifen.
Well, if you talk with the Male Breast Cancer Coalition, there are a number of guys that have gone through that. In fact, I was just was reading about another individual, a friend of mine out in La Jolla, California. And he was put on tamoxifen, and I said, "Well, watch your triglycerides, because for me that was a problem,
Yeah.
So, I mean, hey, this is all an experiment, and
that's
I know we
it.
Don't like to think of ourselves like that, but it's the reality
it
of
mm-hmm.
it.
I agree.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not pleasant to think of ourselves as lab rats, but unfortunately. Everybody's body chemistry is so different that's exactly what it becomes. It becomes an experiment on us, because the doctors have no clue how our bodies are going to respond to the different medications. Mm-hmm. And
right.
Every one of us responds differently. What makes me sick may not faze anybody else. My hair fell out in the 8th week of chemo.
Right.
The 8th week. A lot of people, it falls out pretty early.
Yeah, after like 2.
Was, yeah.
Well, and I think you're 100% right. I mean, it is genuinely an experiment. But I also think, like, you know, it's hard to think about that for ourselves, right? Like, we don't want to be the guinea pigs. However, if there were not people that came before us, they wouldn't know what to do with us now, right?
Oh, and, my, yes.
You know, so we have to have that. And not that I prefer to Absolutely. Think about us that way. But, you know, I mean, I was diagnosed in 2007, March 15th. And I know that's a particular date for you as well. But in 2007, you know, and I really thought about that. I thought hard in terms of, you know, being part of clinical trials so that, you know, somebody down the line, and that would be now, would hopefully benefit from my willingness to participate in those, you know, experimental kind of treatment that was happening. So,
right. Yeah. Now, Melissa, were you de novo? Were you stage four?
I was not.
When you were diagnosed? Mm-mm. You were
no.
not.
No, I was stage two.
Are you now?
No, I'm not.
Good for you. I'm so happy to hear that. That's
Thank
wonderful.
You. Yeah.
But of course, we do know that recurrence occurs in about 30% of those. So
yes.
I'm sure you're keeping a watchful eye.
100%.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and that's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a love hate thing, but it's good to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. Yeah. I did an interview with a lady, and I just adore her. You know, she kind of carries the same attitude that you do. She is so positive, but she had indicated that, you know, she didn't know that 30% of early stage breast cancer goes on to stage four, or progresses to that. And so she wasn't doing the follow-ups, and she didn't know until she had, you know, fallen on the floor from, you know, the cancer kind of being, I guess, so overwhelming in her spine that she broke mm-hmm. her back. And, mm-hmm. You know, so yeah, it was as much as, you know, it's like, oh, another appointment, you know, like, not that I'm going to complain about it, but just, you know, every single year it's the same appointments and I'm like, okay. But it's so important. So yeah,
you have to be diligent about
Absolutely.
That, you know, you really, really do. And I think it's important to convey that to our friends and family mm-hmm. members and those that we, you know, everybody that we meet, that's a real possibility.
Yeah.
Because 30%, that's a significant number. It's not anything to sneeze at, you know.
Right.
So.
Well, and I agree. I remember, you know, like for me, it was really hard just because I was the only person that I knew that was that age that had been diagnosed with breast cancer. I have a family history of it, but I didn't have a relationship with that side of my family.
Mm-hmm.
So I really mm-hmm. was the only person. And I just remember there being somebody that had mentioned something like, oh, but you're only stage two. And I'm like, yes, I understand. But then I found an article and it was about a woman who had the exact same, you know, staging and all of that stuff that I had. And she had progressed to stage four and she passed on. And so I immediately sent that out to my circle. And I just said, you know, I don't want to scare you, but I also don't want to be walking around with rose-colored glasses on. I know that this is a possibility. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's so important. And, you know, I do get discouraged because I know that conversation doesn't happen from the doctor's ends, at least not in my experience.
You're exactly right. It doesn't. And Melissa, I got to tell you, I think so much of really what we're trying to convey and really what we're kind of beating around the bush a little bit about, but it really all kind of boils down to coping mechanisms and learning because of a better understanding. It helps, at least it did for me, it helps me to cope with the reality of what I'm diagnosed with.
Yes.
And, you know, so it makes, look, you can be complacent or you can be resistant or you can be proactive. And you can go and say, oh my, I've got cancer, I'm going to die, and go crawl in a corner and, you know, roll the dice. Or you can just simply do nothing. And that's, again, it's sort of like rolling the dice.
Right.
But I, from the very beginning, said, much like what you were talking about, and that is that you felt this need to go out and try to, you know, to glean more information and to talk to people and to share it with your friends, mm-hmm. because it's so valuable. You know, if you can save a life or make a difference in someone's life, we want to do that. You know, we're the only species in the world that has the ability to share.
Yeah.
And we share our, not only do we share our love, but we share our information, we share our education, we share our experiences and our memories. We share all of that. And that's one of the greatest gifts. And if you're spiritual like I am, I believe that's one of the greatest gifts you get from God.
Right. Well, and it's funny that you say that. I hadn't thought about this for such a long time, but I remember being in high school and saying, it was in this really weird class. It was like an experimental class, speaking of experiments, but it was an experimental class. And I just remember saying that I wanted to work. And at that time, I didn't really have the appropriate language, I suppose, but I said, I want to work with AIDS or cancer patients. And I just remember everybody looking at me like I had four heads. You know, why would I ever want to expose myself to that? And I had always said, I want to save a life, make a difference, and touch a heart. And that's all that I ever wanted to do. And I never thought that I would do it through this.
And how rewarding that is.
What's that?
How rewarding that is.
Yes. Yes. So it's just really weird that you said those exact words. You said, you know, save a life and make a difference. And that was huge for me. And I still, I mean, you know, 13 years later, I'm still striving to do those things.
Yeah. Because I think it takes a certain type of individual. I don't know if it's that A personality or I'm not going to analyze what, you know, type of person it is, but I think it has to deal with a certain type of individual that is willing to stand up and talk about it, talk about their disease in hopes that it impacts somebody in a positive manner.
Yes.
You know, for me, it was immediate. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to tell everybody. And for me, originally, and I laugh about this now, because originally I went around telling everybody, hey, did you know men have breasts and men get breast cancer? And I felt like a stupid recording looking back on it. But now I had in what I call this cancer adventure, this journey that I'm on, I met a lady in Philadelphia at a conference there, and I remember interviewing her, and we just connected so immediately on so many different levels. And I said, I want to ask you a question. Did you know that men get breast cancer? Yes, she said. I said, well, have you ever met anybody? She said, no, you're the first person I've ever met, that first male, you know. And I said, well, so now you know my history a little bit, and you've talked to me about breast cancer and males' breast cancer. And I said, what do you plan on doing about it? She said, you know, Kirby, that's a really good question. And she said, it is just at this moment that I realize that I need to go home and tell my two sons that they need to be tested. Mm. Because you see, it's not the mothers and the aunts and the grandmothers and the sisters worrying solely about their daughters or their grandchildren, their granddaughters. But you need to be concerned about your children, both sexes, because it is not biased. There are no gender boundaries when it comes to breast cancer.
Right.
Well, and that was when that epiphany occurred for me. And the irony of it was she went back and the one son tested BRCA positive, BRCA 1, and the other son was negative. So, you know, potentially she could have saved his life. Unfortunately, about 4 months after that, she passed away.
Oh.
But it was a big takeaway for me. It was it turned my life around. And now I no longer go around saying, hey, did you know men have breasts and we get breast cancer? Because that's not my focus on my mission. That's not what I'm focused on. My focus is now educating people that people get breast cancer.
Yes.
That it is. you know, and that's the huge story right there. And you don't have to be, 58 years old. You don't have to be over menopause. You don't have to have be ready for Social Security to get breast cancer.
Right.
You know, you can be 31 years old. You can be 18.
You can be 13
years old.
You can be 13.
Yes.
I mean, I know that the youngest person in Pittsburgh that had a diagnosis of breast cancer was 13.
Yeah. So, you know, so that's been my takeaway, and that's what the spin, and that's really the mission that I have now, is to educate people and say, it's great that you're concerned about your daughters, but listen up, DNA doesn't care. DNA doesn't care. Genes do not care. Right. They will transfer to both species.
Absolutely. Well, and I think it starts with the doctors, right? Like the doctors don't know. My doctor, when I told my doctor that my paternal side of my family had a history of cancer, including breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, mm-hmm. like all of these things, he just looked at me and
shrugged it off.
Yeah. And he was like, you don't, mm-hmm. you know, your grandmother who had ovarian cancer is too distant. Like you don't get breast mm-hmm. cancer from your dad. And then
that's not true.
Exactly. Not at all. Exactly. Well, that's what came up was, you know, we found out that I had the BRCA2 mutation and it came from the paternal side of my family.
Right.
And he was, I remember him calling me on the phone and saying, I am so sorry. And I was nice about it, but I really thought to myself, like, you should be. You should really be sorry because you're spreading misinformation. So, you know, it's, my hope is that
the doctor called you up. The doctor called you up.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I didn't understand that.
Oh, yeah. My doctor. Oh, yeah. Huge. The doctor called me after. And
that's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. He was floored. He was floored. One, that I had a diagnosis of breast cancer. And then the second part of that was that he was just floored to learn that it came from the paternal side of my family.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, and you know, that talking about the doctors, Melissa, and that's the thing that I think it's almost as important as getting that diagnosis. The doctors need to take it upon themselves. It becomes really incumbent upon the medical staff to provide the patients with some kind of direction in getting help to help cope with the mental aspects.
Gosh, yes.
Because the mental aspects, and I really believe this, I think that they are as important, if not more so, than the diagnosis.
Yes.
Because they can be crippling. They can be death threatening.
Mm-hmm. 100%. The very first thought that I had when I got the phone call. So I got the phone call at work from a doctor that I didn't know. But I got the phone call at work and I never really heard the person say, you know, you have breast cancer. But there were like four women in my office that just, you know, kind of surrounded me. One took the phone. The other one was comforting me. And when I finally picked my head up and kind of processed through everything, the first words weren't, I'm afraid I'm going to die. The first words out of my mouth were, who's going to love me now? You know, like that's where I was. And that is, so I get the whole, like the mental piece of it, and everybody responds differently in that regard. You know, like a lot of people
process things, everything different.
Right.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
You know,
but just the, you know, I think that part is a huge piece that is missing.
Yes. Yeah, that's I think it's called psychosocial.
Yes.
And it really is. It to me is, like I said, it's as significant as the diagnosis.
Yes.
And because of that, I think the doctors really, or the medical staff really need to give you, the patient, some kind of direction. They really need to be able to provide you, say, hey, look, here are some groups and I want you to call them. That's part of your homework. You know, you may not feel like calling them, but you need to call them. You need to connect with these people because they've been down this road. They understand. And you might think you're tough and you're able to handle this all on your own, But trust me, the insight that you are going to gain from just connecting with these people and hearing their stories and what you're going to learn is so valuable.
Right.
I think it's a major part of the puzzle.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, I think we've come a long way with certain things related to cancer, and I still think that we have a long way to go with many other aspects.
Yes, yes.
So I did want to talk about, so we did talk a little bit about, the initial diagnosis, and your treatment for that. But then in 2016, you were diagnosed with recurrence. Can you share a little bit about that?
Well, of course, I'm not going to be closed mouth about it now. Again, this is really, excuse me, these weird things that happen in my life are, you couldn't write them in a script, a Hollywood script. You really couldn't. In 2016, I had, in January, I was fighting pneumonia. Finally, at the end of the month, they did x-rays and my lungs were clear. And no sign of anything. I went home and I had scheduled in the middle of March some very routine cosmetic surgery. And I am not a vain person, but I'm a wimp when it comes to having things cut off. So because of that, I had asked to be put asleep. Again, in the routine test, excuse me, I apologize for that.
No worries.
Let me take a drink here. Maybe that'll help. So again, in the routine preliminary surgical workups, they discovered abnormalities. I really apologize for the coughing. I'm sorry. It is not COVID.
Well, I'm glad. I hope it's not. I don't want it to be.
No. But anyway, so they discovered these abnormalities, and right away, I turned to my wife and I said, my cancer's back. She said, how do you know that? I said, I just do. Now, what surprised me the most was not the fact that it had returned. I'm really having a coughing problem here. I apologize terribly. Let me take just a minute here.
Yeah, no worries.
I'm sorry. So what what really surprised me, shocked me, was the fact that 6 weeks prior to that, my lungs were crystal clear. And now, on the middle of March, 6 weeks later, they lit up with all kinds of cancer cells.
Wow.
And, yeah. And it looked like a Christmas tree. And so that was the thing that amazed me, was how quickly I went from my lungs being clear to the presence of the cancer. Appearance fate. And so that it wasn't the fact that it recurred, because I told my wife, I said, they claim that you're cancer free. They claim that they got everything, but it only takes one little cell.
That's it.
To get through. And the reality is, and if we want to talk biologically, all of our bodies have millions of little cysts in them. It doesn't matter, the healthiest person in the world, we all have these little cysts. But the difference is, in some people, they turn on and they become cancerous, and in others, they're dormant their entire life. And there's no reason they can't decide, they can't determine what, if they could figure that out, they could stop cancer. But for one thing, you've got millions of these, if not billions of these cysts in your bodies. And they're microscopic. They're so small, you can't even detect them until you know, you have once you're dead and they do an autopsy, then they can look and find all of these. Right. But in the meantime, we have all of these cysts that for some reason turn on. And if your body is programmed or receptive to turning on these cysts in an isolated area like the breast, doesn't it kind of lend itself a little credence that there's a possibility that that's going to happen someplace else?
Absolutely.
Now, yeah. Now, for the fact that it was breast cancer that metastasized, that surprised me because I was expecting it to be prostate or liver or, you know, lung cancer or something else. But it wasn't. It was the breast cancer. And, of course, the breast cancer cells have to metastasize. They have to travel out of the breast region to get to these other areas in your body. Right. But, you know, so obviously it's a whole science in and of itself and beyond that. It's incomprehensible science, you know. But it is, nonetheless, that is what happens. And I have a little visual presentation that I show people a lot of times on how a breast cancer cell mutates. And that's the biggest problem with breast cancer, is because a cell's purpose is to divide. And with breast cancer cells, they don't divide and make like breast cancer cells. They divide and they don't look any, the new cells don't look anything like the mother cell. And so how do you fight something that is constantly mutating? Right. I mean, that's touching on a little science, but not probably more so than what I need to at this point. But, you know, these are the kind of problems that, that you know, our scientists, our researchers are faced with. You know, this incredible perplexity of what happens with breast cancer cells that doesn't occur with any other type of cancer.
Right. Well, and there's just so many other complexities as well, right, in terms of, you know, I always think about breast cancer and, you know, whether or not it can be, you know, if there can be a cure that's found or whatever. And, you know, there are just so many different strands of breast cancer.
Sure.
That, you know, sure, there may be a cure for one, you know, but how many really are there, you know? And, you know, again,
and then you get the submutations,
right?
You know, that occur after somebody's been diagnosed. And suddenly, if you're, what is it, a triple negative, mm-hmm. you know, suddenly you're no longer a triple negative, but you've got this other submutation that's occurred. I mean, it's just, that's why I go back to that statement that it's going to be an accident if we ever find a cure.
Right.
It's going to be something that somebody stumbled upon. But in the meantime, we can be hopeful to be able to stop progression. And because that's really the gold standard for anybody that's metastatic.
Right. Yeah.
And really, at anybody at any age, if we can stop progression, or at any stage, right, if we can stop progression, you know, if you've got stage one and we can find a way to stop progression so that it never becomes two, three, or four, you know, that's wonderful. That's the same as curing it, but the, you know, the fine print.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think that's, you know, we're all hopeful and, you know, wanting a cure, but, you know, at this point with what we have, it's really just stopping the progression of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So go ahead.
You know, and that's the other thing that occurred, that I laugh about because it's just so ironic to me. It's just so strange the way our body accepts these chemicals that, you know, the oncologists and things are giving us. And, you know, so I was stage four in March, and after some tests and things that they wanted to determine, you know, exactly, they did a biopsy and things, wanted to determine exactly what type of cancer it was and all of this. They did another needle biopsy into my lung and once that was determined, Then the oncologist had a basis as to how they were going to treat me. I went through my chemo for 16 weeks. And in the process of this, the doctor said, well, how do you feel about clinical trials? And I said, I will do anything you tell me to do. It doesn't matter to me because, I've already got stage 4 cancer. I'm willing to help any way I can. It may make a difference for me, but it might be huge for somebody else. You know? And that's what I was really kind of looking at. I have a grandson and a granddaughter. And so that's what I'm focused on. Something that can make a difference in their generation.
Yeah.
Or for anybody, you know, any small stride that can be gainfully, you know, developed. And if I can play a role in that, that's wonderful.
Absolutely.
And so the irony fell in November the 4th of that year. So I had already been through my chemo and actually was on a Faslodex and Zometa and Ibrance routine and was doing really quite well with that. And the doctor, I had my regular scans and things, and it was still prevalent in, it really had not had any change, but it had not progressed. And so on November the 4th, I had scans scheduled, and she gets my results really quickly. She said that was the reason that she became an oncologist, because she had had a problem, and she just felt like the results took too long to get an answer. So she made it her mission to become an oncologist, and because she wanted to get people the results as quickly as possible.
Good for her.
Yes, absolutely. So she calls me up and she says, hey, Kirby, I've got good news and I've got great news. Now, she's Indian, and I love this lady. I absolutely love her. But I thought, you know, there's a little something lost in the translation here, maybe. It's good news and bad news. And she said, no, this is good news and great news. I said, well, give me the good news. She said, well, the good news is that you got into the clinical trials. I said, well, that's great news. She said, no, the great news is that you're not going to be able to be in the clinical trials. And I said, what? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, you don't have any evidence of disease.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, well, how does that happen? You know, I can't comprehend how that happens. And it happens just as quickly. It left or went silent. It didn't leave, but it disappeared. You know, everything turned off. Those cysts all turned off. Somebody hit that switch, the right switch, you know.
Yeah.
The chemical balance was correct, and it turned those off, and they went away.
And has that been the case over the course of the past 4 years?
No.
Okay.
No, it was, I was no evidence of disease or NED for 34 months.
Okay. Wow.
I felt very good about that. But I have had since August of last year, I guess it was, I had a little spot reappear, and it has had some progression. But it's not been monumental, but it's still, nonetheless, it's been there on my right lung.
Right.
But, you know, it's this whole, and I call it an adventure. I do. And the reason I do is because my mantra when I was growing up as a kid, I had a skiing poster. I loved to downhill ski. And I had a poster on my wall of this guy downhill skiing in powder clear up to his waist. And it said, life is a daring adventure or nothing at all.
Oh, yeah.
And that's been my mantra to live my life. And when I got breast cancer and when it became metastatic, it really hasn't changed. It's still the way I live my life. It's a daring adventure. And, you know, I guess I'll live that until it's nothing at all, until I'm not here, you know. It's the way, I mean, for me, I don't have a choice, you know. I don't have a choice. I just say, you know, I don't want to quit living because I got a bad diagnosis, you know?
Yeah.
Because my diagnosis sucks, but I don't want to quit living. I'm still here. It's just like I said, I died on March the 15th. just pretend that that kind of happened. And every day since has been gravy. It's been extra. And that's the way I choose to live.
Well, I love it. I love your story. You know, I love your passion. I love your attitude. There are just so many things about you that obviously make you Kirby. And I wish that I could meet you in person to give you a hug and, you know, thank you for sharing your story with me and my listeners. I think that the way that we, I think exactly what you just said is the perfect way to end this episode. You've provided a lot of inspiration to many people, I'm sure, and somebody's going to walk away with something from this episode that they didn't have before. So thank you so much.
Melissa, thank you for having me, and I really appreciate your kind words. And someday, you know, hopefully we will meet.
Yes.
And when we do, I'm a big guy. I am 6'3", almost, not quite 300 pounds, but I'm a big guy, about 280. And so I give big Kirby hugs, and that's what everybody knows me. They say, oh, I can't wait. I'm going to get a big Kirby hug. And so hopefully COVID will pass someday soon.
Yes.
And you and I can meet and you will get a big Kirby hug. Well, but thank you so much again for having me.
Absolutely.
Your word means so much to me. And I hope and pray that somehow, some way, it makes this podcast makes a difference for others.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Pink Ribbon. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you or anyone you know would be interested in sharing your story, please send an email to podcast@behindthepinkribbon.com.
Thinking about advertising on this podcast? Our ads not only create awareness for your brand, but also contribute to the continued growth and support of this show. Email us today and be on our next episode. Email podcast@behindthepinkribbon.com for more information. You've been listening to Behind the Pink Ribbon, produced by American Creative Consulting, mixed and mastered at Riverview Podcasting Studios. For more information, please visit designbyacc.com.
Absolutely.